Hi friends. I talk a lot about systems thinking on this podcast and thought I'd share one of the most potent actions you can take if you feel moved to be a different kind of leader for the 21st century. At Small Giants Academy, we developed our answer to the traditional MBA. We call it the MBE, a Mastery of Business and Empathy. The MBE is a truly groundbreaking program which equips leaders with the tools, strategies, networks, and philosophies to lead with purpose in these troubled times. Applications are open now for 2025, so head to smallgiants.com.au/MBE to learn more and sign up.
We need different metrics, and we have to really start with metrics that show the economic value of investing in childcare, investing in really helping people. You know, I think it's investing in our humanity. That's the crux of it. And it is the reward system in economics, not people, that are the problem.
Hi, I'm Berry, and this is the Wisdom in Action podcast, brought to you by the Small Giants Academy. Dr. Rhianne Eisler is a social systems scientist, a cultural historian, futurist, and former attorney whose research, writing, and speaking has transformed the lives of people worldwide. Having fled from the Nazi regime in Vienna as a child, Dr. Rhianne's experiences instilled in her a deep commitment to understanding the roots of violence and oppression in human societies. Her groundbreaking book, The Chalice and the Blade, introduced many influential concepts such as partnership societies versus dominator societies. And her and I, in our conversation, dive into the caring economy because I've just read her seminal work, The Real Wealth of Nations. Her most recent book, Nurturing Our Humanity, further articulates her thesis for how we remake our institutions for human and natural flourishing. Rhianne is epic. She is 93 years old and the embodiment of the kind of wisdom we need to download and implement now while we still have time. Her ideas blew my mind, cracked open my soul a little bit, and all I can say is get ready. This is a big one, folks. Rhianne, it's so wonderful to be connected to you. I've been a bit nervous about our conversation today.
Oh, no.
Because it feels like I am still resistant in many ways to a lot of the ideas that you've been writing about, talking about. You've been such an extraordinary leader in this space. What is an alternative economic model? And we're up against the precipice of catastrophic ecological and human collapse and polarization, the fact that we cannot actually collectively make sense of things together anymore because there's just alternative facts and alternative truths and a lot of shouting and screaming because of the outrage algorithm. I'd love to have a conversation about your work.
My life is really a lot like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. I didn't know for a long time what my calling was. I'm a child refugee from the Holocaust. And my parents and I, we escaped my native Vienna by a hair's breadth. And I was a very traumatized child because on Kristallnacht, a gang of Nazi Gestapo men, Austrian and German, came to our home and they dragged my father off. And my mother recognized one of the men, an Austrian, as a young man who had been an errand boy in the family business. And she got furious. And she could have been killed that night. You know, many Jewish people were killed during Kristallnacht, so-called, because of all the glass shattered in Jewish homes, synagogues, businesses. But by a miracle, she wasn't. And she got my father back. My parents managed to get out. We left at night. They purchased an entry permit to Cuba. which at the time was one of only two places, Shanghai and Cuba, that let Jewish refugees in. And my parents had no idea what to tell me, I'm sure, and I think they were very traumatized. And, you know, people didn't in those days explain things to children. But growing up in Cuba was very difficult for me. And it was in the course of these experiences that I formed questions, you know, does it have to be this way? When we have such a tremendous capacity for caring, for consciousness, for creativity, why has there been so much cruelty, so much insensitivity, so much destructiveness? And many years later, I started my multidisciplinary, cross-cultural, transhistorical research to answer that question. But I realized that I could not find answers to these questions using the conventional social categories. And I really want to emphasize that because they fragment our consciousness. And so, frankly, do the conventional approaches. I had to devise a new methodology, the study of relational dynamics, looking at relationships. First of all, what kind of relationships does the social system support or inhibit? But also, what are the major intervention points, the major nuclei that are mutually supporting in the system? And I immediately saw that both our categories and our studies marginalize nothing less than, well, the majority of humanity, women and children, and hence family. So mine is really a whole systems approach. And I pay attention, as I point out in my latest book, Nurturing Our Humanity, that neuroscience, it verifies what we know from psychology, that you cannot really understand people's paradigm without looking at family, without looking at children. And yes, this takes us straight to economics, at what I call a gendered system of values, in which anything stereotypically coded feminine, you know, caring, caregiving, nonviolence, are simply devalued. And our systems reflect this, especially our economic systems.
At the Small Giants Academy, which is our institute here in Australia, we teach a lot about next economy principles, as we're all kind of hunting in the dark, if you will, for models for systems dynamics that we can use to pivot while we still have time. This is in this book, The Real Wealth of Nations. The devaluation and exploitation of caring and caregiving is our inheritance from times in which women's bodies and women's work were male property. As a consequence, women and anything associated with women were basically invisible in economic thinking, which focused on transactions between men. It's incredibly interesting that your works had to go to relational dynamics and then into systems thinking. I guess it's where to start with the economy or to start with the relational dynamics. So,
they're interconnected. You can't look at economics in a vacuum. It doesn't just spring up in a vacuum. Families don't spring up in a vacuum. All of our institutions are part of a larger social, economic, cultural system. And that's why my work is basically about changing our paradigm, which takes us to gender, frankly. But it also takes us to childhood, because we know from psychology, from neuroscience, that what children experience and observe in their first 5 years, and a lot of that takes place in families, that this shapes our worldview. Fortunately, not everybody who's raised in a domination family, which usually comes with a domination-oriented religious, social, etc. environment, quite a few people reject this system of values in which there are only two possibilities. You either dominate or you're dominated. There is no partnership alternative. But a lot of people don't. And these are severely traumatized people.
My brain is going in many different directions. So maybe the best place for us to start is your thesis about dominance versus partnership models.
It is foundational because, as I said, the old social categories, which we inherited from more rigid domination times, you know, right, left, religious, secular, Eastern, Western, none of them, first of all, describe the whole system. None of these categories, if you really think about it, tells us what we have to build as an alternative. They basically, there have been regressive, repressive, violent regimes in every one of these categories. And all of them marginalize, as I said, the majority of humanity, women and children, and hence family.
I've been very resistant to go and have a conversation about gendered behavior or gendered systems thinking because there are plenty of women who are passionate about Marxist ideology and think that we need to have a radical revolution and overthrow the current outdated and outmoded systems and institutions. I think if you can articulate what this dominance versus partnership modeling is, it is quite a remarkable intervention of thinking. You have articulated something that needed the right moment in history to land, because a woman who's Marxist and wants to have a radical revolution is actually just buying into the dominance model.
Absolutely.
And what we get is maybe it looks like a different system, but it's the same monsters in us. And we actually get no change, which we saw with Stalin versus capitalism. It's been a battle for which model is the one, and it's supposed to be a model that serves the most people. And I would say we now need a model that serves the most people and life on earth.
We're back to values, always back to values. Let me start perhaps with something that we don't usually think of in economics, which is that both capitalism and socialism, they came out of the 1700s and the 1800s, very early industrial times. And while both challenged a tradition of domination, I mean, the control of the resources by kings and so-called nobles, and then Marx came and he challenged the bourgeoisie. But the problem is that both perpetuated this built-in gendered system of values, so that it's firmly entrenched in both. The work of caring for people was to be done for free by a woman in a male-controlled household, so much so that even as late as when Marx wrote, because, you know, I also have a background as an attorney in my multidisciplinary approach, in many jurisdictions, a wife, and most women were wives, could not sue for injuries negligently inflicted on her. Only her husband could for loss of her services. We need to understand where these models came from. As for caring for our natural life support systems, for both Smith and Marx, nature was there to be exploited, period. Caring was associated with women. Then, of course, you know, Mother Earth was also, quote, feminine. This isn't a question of biological gender. This is a question of the cultural construction of the roles and relations of, yes, the two basic forms of humanity, female and male, and everyone in between.
So can you say what is the dominance model?
If you forget about the conventional categories, because these categories transcend them, the domination or dominator or dominance model has, first of all, in the family, as well as in economics and in society at large, it is a top-down authoritarian model in domination systems, and you see it in the Taliban, in fundamentalist Iran, you know, you see it in Western religions like the Rightist Fundamentalist Alliance in the West. You saw it in Hitler's Germany, a secular society, and you saw it in Stalin's former Soviet Union. I mean, his wife committed suicide because he was so brutal to her, really. We have all been taught to think of these issues as just a women's issue, or now as just a gender issue, right? Actually, as we spoke about economics, it's a key family, social, and economic organizing principle. The values that we have inherited, because it isn't just these very rigid gender stereotypes, it's the ranking in domination systems of men and, quote, masculinity as culturally defined now in domination systems, whether they're Eastern, Western, secular, religious, it doesn't matter, really. This movement towards gender fluidity, towards men accessing their, quote, soft, because men get emotions in domination systems. They get anger and contempt, right? But they don't get the soft, quote, feminine emotions. You know, that's unmanly.
Forgive my naivete, because I haven't been thinking about these things as long as you, which is why I'm so lucky to be talking to you. Isn't it also that the patriarchy wins because men are stronger than women? And there is a violence and a fear, and there is a kind of fundamental biological aspect to this that I don't know how we move to a partnership model, which you're yet to articulate. But a dominance model, the patriarchy itself, I've talked about it around the menstrual cycle. Women are so physically bound to, this is not going to be a popular thing for me to say, but so physically bound to vulnerability. Not only do we have a four-week cycle that has bleeding in the component parts of it, but also hormonal fluctuations, mood fluctuations, cognitive fluctuations, but we also bear children and then are part of caregiving. It is all so vulnerable. And if I was a man, and I was this stronger testosterone-pumped homo sapien, it makes sense that the dominance model would win. The survival of the species requires women to sublimate so many of their own needs and wants in service of the community. How? I'm just still getting my head around it.
You know. Have summarized a very popular conception of the relationship between women and men, one in which there are only these two alternatives, and one is meant naturally or biologically to dominate. The thing is that history doesn't support that. If you look at the millennia of gathering hunting, the evidence is very clear that isn't that way at all. I had been working on Nurturing Our Humanity, my latest book, for 7 years when I invited the anthropologist Douglas Fry. He's one of the world's authorities on foraging societies, and he calls them the original partnership societies. Now, why? I mean, it's true, women bear children. But, you know, there have been a lot of studies. A very prominent archaeologist, Ian Hodder, who excavated Çatalhöyük, and he wrote an article in the Scientific American that being born male or female did not affect one's status in life. For the last 5,000 to 10,000 years, which is really a drop in the evolutionary bucket. And that's what I'm trying to communicate. We have been told false stories about human nature, you know, whether it's original sin or selfish genes, it's the same story. I mean, they fight each other, but we're bad. We have to be rigidly controlled from the top, as in God-fearing. You know, the Nordic nations, Finland, Sweden, Norway, they're much more partnership oriented. They're not socialists. They have a very healthy market economy. And I want to really emphasize that. And it's not because they're relatively homogeneous, because think of all the relatively homogeneous small societies that orient very much to the domination system. But they have gender equity as one of their ideals. I want to finish with the description of the two models. If you have a model where somebody has to be on top, you know, to dominate, and somebody is on bottom, you also need a lot of built-in abuse and violence. I mean, there's some violence as you move to the partnership model, but consider not only the first peace academies came out of the Nordic nations, which are more partnership-oriented, but the first laws, and this is fundamental, the first laws saying that using physical discipline on children is against the law. What do children learn in a domination family, which is highly punitive and often very violent, and certainly rigidly male-dominated and authoritarian? Children learn that it's normal, even moral, for those who are bigger and stronger to use violence against those who are smaller and weaker. It's taught.
I understand what you're saying. I'm having a lot of resistance. And the resistance in me is what you're asking for, or what you're speaking to, is a complete healing of a world that is traumatized by a dominance model.
Yes.
And that's not possible, that it's too late, that we are so embedded in our dominance model. Even in my own family, that brings up for me, you know, times that we've dominated the kids for efficiency. We need to get out of the house. You're being a pain. Dominating them in order to have a functioning day, for example. So I'm justifying it, but I think
children do need limits. I wrote a book on education, and we're talking about either formal or informal education. And we want to teach our children self-regulation, not self-discipline, self-control. In the 60s, you know, we mistook rebellion for reconstruction. And I think we're in a period now of reconstruction because we have to. We absolutely have to, because the domination system, guided by an ethos, our level of high technology, really, it's not sustainable. And I think that a lot of people like you are seeing that. And yes, it is late in the game. For example, a campaign like the Nordic nations, they have more caring policies. Half of their legislature, the national legislature, is female. And we all know women like Maggie Thatcher are, you know, who are very much towards the domination side. But women do care because we're brought up to care. And because of our biology, it's probably somewhat easier for us to learn to care. But the suppression of women and so-called femininity has been a disaster.
It has been a disaster. And then I think, Rhianne, I know we're talking about a meta story of humanity, and that we need rapid healing of how the dominance model has pushed us all into a terrible existential corner. So we are in this moment where we need to evolve, and everyone's talking about the evolution of human consciousness. And I think that what you're talking about is a huge part of what has to evolve in our consciousness, even though while I'm listening to you, it feels impossible because it's so embedded in all of us. And when I hear you talking about self-regulation as opposed to self-control, these are very nuanced, very subtle orientations, and they require a lot of maturity and self-work and sophistication to get to if you're an adult doing it retrospectively. And I know a lot of adults who are trying to parent in this way. And then we talk about boundaries and what those regulatory boundaries are. What I'm hearing is you're talking about human behavior and human care and human formation, like how we become evolved human beings, happens and starts in the family, and that the economy itself is an overlay of the family structure writ large.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very good way of summarizing it.
So, Rianne, we are being nonlinear and trying to articulate so many complex ideas. And at the same time, I keep coming back to the economy as it is. And I want you to explain what is the real wealth of nations so that we can start to talk about domains and measurement and price versus value. Yes. There are so many kind of gritty layers here. And I know everyone listening, we all engage in the economy. That's why I feel it's so important for us all to think about the system itself, the story itself, culture as a whole. And right now, I feel like we are stuck in polarization and binary ideas of how we get from A to B, but we need a consciousness shift. And so what is the partnership model? And what is the real wealth of nations?
Let me for a moment go to economics, if I may, because it isn't that we want to do away with markets or capitalism, and it isn't that we want to do away with government policies. We need markets. We don't happen to have a free one. And we certainly need enlightened government policies. But the problem goes much deeper. And that's what we have to understand. So this whole argument between capitalism and socialism, it's a distraction. It's a red herring. Mm. Of course, we need both enlightened government policies and markets. Now, you ask me, what does a partnership model look like? Well, a model is an abstraction. So that's why I always talk about a partnership domination social scale or a partnership domination biocultural lens, because that whole argument between nature and nurture, again, it's a red herring. Mm. It is not nature or nurture, it is nature and nurture, okay? Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the contemporary advanced, technologically advanced societies, which are the Nordic nations. Now, they're not ideal, but as I said, they're not socialists. And they do have the configuration very close to the partnership system, which is more democracy rather than authoritarian top-down rule in both family, economics, and the state. Mm. Secondly, their normative ideal is not wait till your father gets home and, you know, spare the rod and spoil the child and, you know, all of the rest of it. It is a gender equity. And you see that normative ideal play itself out in their caring policies, because as the status of women rises, so does both men and women in the Nordic nations support caring policies. Paid parental leave, health care. And there are trends all over the world in that direction. But built into the domination system is this in-group versus out-group thinking. Mm. It's okay for the in-group, starting with the in-group of mankind and the female other, right? We are taught to equate difference with superiority or inferiority, with dominating or being dominated, with the whole thing is a construct. And once we unpack this, we can begin to see how it plays out. Men support caring policies in the Nordic nations. It isn't just women. And it isn't everybody, by the way. But the norm, what do we support? Do we support the qualities that are about to do us in? Or do we support the qualities that make us really human, humane? And as for violence, I don't have to tell you. I mean, Putin in 2018, he did something very curious. He significantly lowered the penalty for family violence. Now, why? You have to ask yourself, why would he do that? because he gets that connection. We have to learn to connect the dots, which is very hard because our education is so fragmented. Our categories are so fragmenting. But he gets the connection between a highly punitive, often violent, top-down authoritarian and rigidly male-dominated family and that same kind of a state. So I am really addressing a lot of my work now to people who consider themselves progressive because the people pushing us back have a very unified frame. It's a domination model, and I don't care whether it's the Taliban or whether it's fundamentalist Iran or whether it's Putin's Russia. It doesn't matter. It sends, it's the domination configuration. And the stories and the language that we use have to be really examined and fact-checked.
Everything you're saying is resonating very deeply, and it's kind of hard to take it in because you have to let go of so much of the old story that basically the economy is a boxing ring, and if you're not in there to fight, you'll get punched down. And you'll be leaving the ring bloody and wounded. And that's how most people feel. But you're right that the story of the progressive-minded folk on the planet has been absolutely diluted by the culture wars and by Puritanism and by authoritarian behavior from within the progressive movement. And it's been one of the tragedies of my adult life to see this splintering, because then we can't collectively agree on these core values and proceed accordingly with thoughtful strategic action.
Well, I've written a lot about this. We need both short-term tactics, which we have plenty of on the progressive side, but we also need long-term strategies. And those strategies have to focus on four cornerstones, four pillars. One is childhood and family. Psychology, neuroscience, common sense, studies, they all show the same thing. If we learn to equate difference, whether it's a different race or a different religion, it doesn't really matter. Do you see what I'm saying? It's in-group versus out-group, and that's built into domination systems. And yes, gender is what all children are familiar with in their families. Economics, and again, I think that the argument between socialism and communism, it's a red herring. We really need to look at the metrics. What are we measuring? And we've tried and have not succeeded, I must say, to get metrics built that show the economic value of the work of caring for people starting at birth and caring for our natural life support systems. Because in the post-industrial era, even economists who are very indoctrinated, okay, they tell us that the most important capital is what they like to call high quality human capital. You know, resilient, creative people who can not just give or take orders, but solve problems. We know from neuroscience that whether or not we have this capital hinges to a very large extent on the quality of care and education children receive in their first years. This, quote, women's work, which is so devalued. It's family, gender, economic control from the top, and it is story and language.
It brings up the Oscar Wilde quote for me. He said that a fool is someone who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. So if your core thesis is that caring and caregiving need to be included and valued, but price is not a good measure of value, then can we value the care economy without putting a price on it?
I think that we have to put a price on it, and we have to pay caregivers in both the market and non-market economy. How? I don't know. You know, I'm a concept. Yes. Person. But it can be done.
I know this is the same as the ecology. So caregiving, the family, human flourishing is directly linked to the ecology, because what we have done is priced carbon, but we're not talking about whole healthy ecological systems. And you're talking about whole healthy family ecologies, that these two things should be and actually are cornerstones to the survival of our species, let alone the thriving of our species. And yet we haven't even got a proper market for high quality biodiversity credits. And you're talking about high quality human care credits. I don't know what we would call it. But,
I mean, we have some examples. We have the Nordic nations and about 50 other nations now have on their books laws saying that physical discipline of children is not what we want. I mean, we have examples of policies that have worked.
Yes, policies of paying families for childcare, paying families where both parents get parental leave. Like, what about the danger of perverse incentives? If you get paid by the state to be a parent, well, then you'll be a parent. When we put a price on the sacred, like we put a price on love and we put a price on healthy nature, there's something sacrilegious that happens there, and it feels like a dangerous tool to be using, because it's such a perverse tool, because there are all the traumatized people in the world that are just looking to gamify whatever system we put in place.
I don't have a pat answer for you. I know that we have to, because if we don't do this, well, look at the alternatives, for goodness sake. And look at climate change. And denial, by the way, is a characteristic of the traumatization of domination system, whether it's climate change denials, COVID-19 denial, election result denial. And the denial starts in the family, denying that people on whom we are dependent cause us pain. And it isn't a question of blaming or shaming. People are just doing what they were taught. So our job is to change the normative ideals.
They are big concepts, and it's very hard because the resistance is strong, even in my own mind. And I'm on,
of course,
I'm on board with a caring economic system. And of course, I'm on board with future generations thriving on this planet in a living world. And it's very profound what you're saying. I think I just feel a bit emotional all of a sudden. Just struggling to allow myself the story to be different.
Allow yourself for the story to be different. And it's we who tell the story in the last analysis. Mm-hmm. We can change the story. That is a very important observation. So much of the stories that we're taught, like the fairy tales, poor Sleeping Beauty, she can't even wake up without a prince kissing her, right? Cinderella, you know, I mean, my God. And notice they're all princes and royalty, those on top, and they never do wrong. I mean, what are we teaching?
It's funny, because I think in those stories, what I always took away from it, and you're talking about the subconscious things, what I always took away from it was love and connection, because I think that was what I was hardwired for. I keep orienting to love and connection and what is getting in the way, and so much is getting in the way. And the questions, I think, for all of us listening to you is how to do this, because, of course, the economy as it is doesn't include a domain for household caring.
No. I mean, the three really non-markets that are left out of both capitalism and socialism are the natural economy, the volunteer community economy, and the household economy. We have to figure out a way of doing it. You know, I love the fact that you are talking about the difficulty, because it isn't a simple thing, but people do change. And there was this change from more of a partnership orientation to the domination system.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really look at all the social movements, the progressive social movements of the last 300 years, when it was a period of disequilibrium, when the Industrial Revolution went into high gear, they all charged the same thing, a tradition of domination. I mean, think the Enlightenment challenged the so-called divinely ordained right of kings to rule their subjects, the abolitionists and then the civil rights and the Black Lives Matter movement challenged this so-called divinely ordained of a, quote, superior race to rule over inferior ones, the feminist and then the women's movement, and which is a global movement, challenged the so-called divinely ordained right of men to rule over the women and children in the castles of their homes, all the way to challenging our once hallowed conquest and domination of nature. So we've got to connect the dots.
I'm struggling to have faith and trust in humanity, because when there is a bully in the playground, any bully, I don't care if they're progressive or conservative, because I think, you know, Jonathan Haidt talks about the righteous mind and the fact that progressives thinks they have ownership of the ideas that will take us into the future of kindness and virtue, but it's not true. Virtue is now a dirty word. And conservatives value family and loyalty and many things that hold communities together in a good way over a long period of time.
But they only value a certain kind of family.
Yes, but you understand that as polarization increases and Putin is in the playground, Netanyahu is in the playground, Trump is in the playground, any human kind of collective, the bullies really do take over. They take out the oxygen. And so I'm not good with a bully. I struggle. You have to have a lot of self-awareness, confidence, presence of mind, language. You know, you need to be able to stand up to a bully. You really have to have some kind of spiritual spinal cord to really own the space and take it back from them without violence. Because what are the drivers of human innovation without money or status playing a part if we move away from the dominance model?
First of all, if you look at the mythology that what we need is more cooperation, that's not the difference between the domination and the partnership model, because cartels cooperate, invading armies cooperate, gangs cooperate. They're all within that model. And there's also competition in both. But, and this is, again, comes down to what we value and what are our normative ideals. You know, we hear a lot about so-called dog-eat-dog competition, but there is competition, a different kind of competition, which is striving for excellence. You know, I see that you're doing something really well. I want to also do that. It's a question of degree.
And I hear you talking about meaning and purpose, that the drivers for us to innovate have for eons been meaning and purpose, to live a meaningful life. And I yes. think that many people since COVID are asking that, what is a meaningful life for this short time that I'm here? And how can I incentivize myself differently? There are the basic human necessities that are still driven by money in a market economy, but what else has value? And I think that GDP has measured, and therefore we have valued, most things that do not make life worth living.
GDP is a disaster. First of all, it includes underproductive activities that actually harm and take life. You know, fast foods, smoking, you name it. And all of the medical bills that result from it and the funeral bills, they're all great for GDP. A storm is great for GDP. A change is great for GDP, you know, because you have all of the costs of rebuilding things. So we need different metrics, and we have to really start with metrics that show the economic value of investing in childcare, investing in really helping people. You know, I think it's investing in our humanity. That's the crux of it. And it is the reward system in economics, not people, that are the problem. because you ask people what gives their life purpose, and it's very often it's their caring connections, isn't it? So let's examine what we reward and what we should be rewarding. And then let's figure out how to do it. I don't have all the answers by any means, but I know that we need this frame. We have to connect the dots. We can't just keep on leaving out the majority of humanity and also our natural life support systems, for goodness sakes, out of the equation, that there's something really wrong with the present systems. That doesn't mean we throw out the baby with the bathwater.
It's making me think of orientation models. So I'd love to, Rianne, what else should we be looking at? What other models should we be understanding as we evolve our consciousness and evolve the economy?
I feel very strongly that we really need to have a different way of looking at our societies, at our families, at our economics. And this partnership domination social scale helps us connect the dots. So there is another thing that we need to work on. But, you know, I think that we need to work with the media. You mentioned conservative. I think that is misleading to lump everybody. I mean, they call the Taliban conservative. They're not conservative. They're domination-oriented.
It's an amazing distinction, because I think we can all identify in conservative or progressive or any room that you're in, you can identify a partnership versus domination.
Yes. And children, if you ask them what's your best relationship and what's your worst relationship, they'll tell you. And it always turns out to be domination or partnership. You know, I'm respected, I'm heard, I'm listened to, because we mistake in domination systems respect and fear. And we could do this for a long time. So I think that let's talk really about some practical things.
Yes,
that
please.
Let's do together. What we need very desperately are tools. And one of the tools that we've developed at the Center for Partnership Systems is a partnership toolkit, which is a self-assessment tool to see what did our family really think? What do we think? Where do we fall? We're working on getting, it's all happening in red states, strangely enough. There's a man at the University of Arkansas who is teaching a world history, global history, using the partnership domination social scale. Let's get it into the academy. I'm working with the Montessori Foundation on teacher education, but we need many nodes to do things. And of course, there are the new metrics that we need very badly, really paying attention to the devalued work and why it is so essential for human flourishing and, frankly, for human survival. We're back to we value what we measure and we measure what we value, aren't we?
It's profound. Rianne, thank you so much for your time. It's been so illuminating. I'm going to be thinking about this for days and weeks and months.
And it's been a pleasure to talk with you. And I love your questioning mind. I think that we need that. And we also need what I call spiritual courage, you know, which is the courage to just, I think my mother displayed that. It's the courage to really stand up against injustice out of love. I mean, that's what she did.
Amazing. What a privilege. Holy moly. Rianne Eisler, 93 years old and sharper than me, that is for sure. I'm a little bit shell-shocked. I don't know why. It's sort of all the conversations I've been having this year have sort of led me to here, and it was such a privilege to, I think, in a way, get a glimpse into emergent futures, that thing where you go, oh, we really need to elevate our consciousness. Oh, humanity needs a new path forward. And it's that thing of it's right in front of you, peeps. It's right there for the taking. But it requires that we let go of old stories and invite new or maybe even ancient ones back into our way of being. And the dominance versus partnership model, to understand it. Like, I'm still processing, and I know a lot of people will be processing with me, but what a worthy task, because we can choose a different story. I've been talking about the patriarchy. We have to talk about these things, not in terms of culture wars and not even in terms of blame and shame. None of that. We don't have time for that shit. We have to really let these ideas sink in. And for all the economists who may be listening to this conversation, we need you to get on board, because we need alternative indicators that measure gender and families, that help us get better inputs so that we can have better outputs. Rhianne Eisler, thank you so much. This was the Wisdom in Action podcast, brought to you by the Small Giants Academy. If you want to turn this wisdom into action, go to smallgiants.com.au for more information about the programs we run. We love hearing from you, so tell us what you think by leaving a rating and review on your favorite podcast app, or email us at podcast@smallgiants.com.au.